Jesus heals a man with a demon. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus stepped out of the boat, immediately there met a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he had wrenched free of them and broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night came, night and day, among the tombs, on the mountains. He was always crying and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. And the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep hill into the sea and drowned. The herdsmen fled and told it to the city and the country. And the people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to see Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by the demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled.
With the story of the passage that I'm going to preach on this morning actually comes from a conversation with Nicodemus, who is from Tanzania, or Tanzania as he calls it. Nicodemus and I would meet on Wednesday afternoons before our Thursday large group dinner and discussion, and we'd talk about the passage. He was a Christian, and he'd never really studied the Bible, and so we read this passage, and we got through with it, and he said, "That is a beautiful story." And so that's the reason for the title that we gave it. And you heard the story read. I appreciate that. It is a very explicit and very graphic picture and depiction of an individual, but also a bold and beautiful proclamation of the love and the grace and the mercy of Jesus as well. Let me start by just telling you a little story. This is a story that I heard from a friend, and it was written up in a news journal, and I went back and pulled the journal and read it, and so I've got the facts right here in front of me, so it's must be true, right? But it is true, and I think just after going through worship, I think this will land here with you. But it was a Tuesday evening. Imagine yourself a Tuesday evening late in August of 2001. And there was this little jazz bar, this dive up in Greenwich Village in New York. And this journalist walks into this jazz bar. It's in the season when there's not a whole lot going on. And honestly, a lot of the jazz bars had closed, but this one had been around for 60-some-odd years. And so he walks in, and the group playing that night was not anything special. They were known, but they were not great, but they were well known. And he said his eyes kind of drifted off to the side, and he noticed a trumpet player. And the trumpet player was kind of turned away and not really facing the audience. I guess that's kind of a trumpet player thing. I don't know. And he was kind of staring at the floor, and he looked at him, and he said, "He looks vaguely familiar." But he said it couldn't be. He thought maybe it's an older version of Wynton Marsalis. And so they play a song, and then this trumpet player moves out to the center and does a solo. And he was sitting next to a gentleman, and he said, "Is that Wynton Marsalis?" And he said, "I don't think so." This man was dressed in an Italian fine-cut suit, blue tie, and had the elegance of what you might expect from a Wynton Marsalis. But he was a lot older and a lot heavier. And as the song finished, he began to play a fourth song. And at that fourth song, the trumpeter takes center stage, and it became really clear that it actually was Wynton Marsalis, the famous jazz trumpeter. And he started playing this, he describes it as this melancholy piece that is just filled with murmurs and sighs at different points, and he's making his way through this piece of music. And as he reached the climax, as he reached that point where it speaks, he comes to this each note with such declarative intent. He's moving along, and he just kind of plays a note and it lets it linger. And he's moving along, and you can feel it, and it's building, and it's building, and it's getting ready for it. And about that time, in the moment of silence, a cell phone ring goes off. You know, one of those rings or whatever it would be. And it keeps going, and you know, you're the guy's scrambling, trying to find it, and finally finds it, and he slips away. And it's just silence. He said he wrote on a napkin, "Magic ruined," and he slid it over to the next guy. But then Marsalis began to play that ringtone. Just simply playing that ringtone. And as he continued, that ringtone would morph into a little bit more. And morphed into a little bit more. Until finally, the recognizable song that he had been playing was where he was ending up, and he finished with the climax that had been interrupted, and the place went crazy. I love that story. I've told it. You may have heard me tell it. I don't have any idea, but it's such a beautiful picture of so many different things. And this morning, I think what I want to think about as we live in this world where every day seems to be filled with some sad news. We ourselves are familiar with sadness and how it interrupts our lives, and how we are in need of some sort of redemption, some way that we could come and take these sad things and make them untrue. We need a redeemer. And this passage that we look at today, I think, provides us with some sad ringtones, if you will, that are redeemed. So if you'll look with me at this passage, I want us to look at it under three real simple headings. And the first one is just, who is Jesus? And I would say that Jesus is the one that shows up. He shows up in the midst of those sad seasons and hard seasons and difficult seasons of our life. Maybe you've got a person like that in your life. Maybe you've got somebody that shows up. Maybe it's a text, maybe it's a phone call, maybe it's a knock on the door. But Jesus shows up, and he tells these disciples, if you flip back to chapter 4, that he's going to take these disciples to the other side. They go through the storm in the boat, and then they reach the other side. And when they reach the other side, this man shows up. This single man rushes down the beach. And he's been described as a specimen of degraded, mangled humanity. I don't think that's too much. I think it's pretty accurate. He's unclothed. I don't know if you caught that or not. He's uncontrollable. He's unclean. He's unavoidable. And it's into this man's chaos and sadness that Jesus enters. He's unclothed. He doesn't have any clothes on. He's uncontrollable because he can no longer be chained. He's broke the chains apart. He's unclean because he lives among the dead. He's in a region of pigs. He's demon-possessed. And Jesus enters into this man's humiliation. This man's shame that's probably long gone by now. It's just buried under layer and callous layered of shame after shame and embarrassment that it's probably not even affecting him anymore. He lives alone in the tombs, rejected by the people. We know nothing of his family. Isolated, despair. Maybe you sing a song, destitute, despised, forsaken. Think about it when I think about this man. The disciples had just moments earlier asked the question, who is this man that can stand up and calm the waves? I wonder what they're thinking now. Let me tell you who Jesus is. He is the one that shows up where no one else will go. He is the one that seeks when others have stopped looking. He is the one who will go through a storm to seek the one who is desperate. Why? Because he wants them to know and us to know that there's no situation that is unredeemable. And that there's no one too far gone, that they're too dirty or desperate. He is the one that seeks out those in need. The power and the authority that quiets the raging sea is now standing in front of this wreck of a man, preparing to silence another storm that is assaulting this image bearer of God. A few weeks ago, I had the privilege of baptizing a Chinese student that was in school at Clemson. Juan showed up in America about probably 11 years now ago and began attending grad school at UT in Knoxville, Tennessee. And he met his advisor, who also had a Bible study, a weekly Bible study, and they invited Juan to come and be a part of this Bible study. And Juan would go to this Bible study. Mind you, he had no reference point of who God was. Zero. But his advisor invited him. He thought that'd probably be a good idea to go. So he went. And Juan, every week, they would ask for prayer requests, and Juan would raise his hand and said, please pray for me as I write my thesis. So the professor would pray for him as he wrote his thesis. And he would also pray for him to have a relationship with Jesus. Juan said he would take that, but he was really interested in the thesis. Over those 10 years, he made his way ultimately here to Clemson. And during COVID, or a little bit before COVID, he would come to an English conversation class that took place Clemson Prez through the ministry of RUFI. I was not there. And he met some people, but still had was not on the radar of him. He'd heard sermons from his advisor. He'd heard different things and stuff like that, but none of that really registered. But then during COVID, something began to happen. That seed, which had been planted 10 years previously, began to take root. And he sought out some people. And I come to find out from two other internationals in our group that one wants to become a Christian. So we met at Eggs Up one morning for breakfast, and for an hour and a half, I listened to him tell me his story. Let me just read you the first line and the last line of his testimony. It is a long and struggling path for me to become a Christian. And God never abandoned me because I disbelieved in his existence. Last line. I want to receive Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior and be a Christian following his life and teaching. It will be a great way to spend the rest of my life. I don't know if you catch the marvel of this, but this is a man who did not even believe in God, that God brought to faith. God was not on his radar at all. We continue this day to read. Listen, at Christmas, I said, Juan, have you ever read the Christmas story? No. I said, we will read the Christmas story this Sunday. So he came to my office and we read the Christmas story. Nothing. And God brought life to this man. Who is Jesus? Jesus shows up in the most unexpected places, in the most unexpected ways, in the lives that seem to be unreachable. And he does his thing. What is his thing? What is his thing when he shows up? What is the mission of Jesus? Back when the Queen died, I guess last year, a friend of mine posted a note on one of our my groups that I'm a part of, and he retold the story of when he was visiting England, was in Parliament, and asked the guy given a tour. He said, "What's the most interesting story you've ever heard about the Queen?" And so he tells him. He said, every legislative session begins with a visit from the Queen. And it's a very regal tradition. The Queen will dress up in all of her regalia and the crown, and she will make her way down this hallway where the soldiers are standing against it, and they will strike their swords against the stone walls, and sparks are flying. It's really pretty amazing, he said, as they do this. But several years ago, the Queen became too old to make her way down the steps. And so they came up with a different plan. She would get on the elevator, and they would take her to the right floor, and then they would drop her off. And it sounded like a good plan. But the first year, there was a mistake, because when she got onto the elevator, the lift operator accidentally pushed the wrong button. And rather than entering into Parliament, they ended up on the bottom floor, which is the maintenance floor. And when the doors opened, Alice, the maintenance worker, pushed her cart in to the elevator, pinning the Queen against the back of the elevator, recognizing that she had done something unusual. Alice looks up, expletive, right there in front of the Queen, and there's silence. And the Queen busted out laughing, to the relief of the lift operator. And they said, Alice, you're going to have to get off. And the Queen said, no, she's not. And they proceeded to go to the main floor and walk out, the Queen and Alice, the maintenance worker, through this procession with swords striking the wall and all of the beauty. It's a beautiful story that even ends even better, that once a year, Alice was invited to Buckingham Palace for tea with the Queen and did that up until her death. But that story reminds me of what we see here in this passage, because it's a revelation of the humanity of Jesus. As you see the humanity, don't we just love it when somebody who has that power, that authority, and then she's like a normal person. Like, when I say she laughed, you laugh because like, whew. Well, she laughed because it could have really gone south there quick. But we appreciate that. And this is not just a picture of Jesus' humanity here, but it's a picture of his mission. And much like what the queen does, she takes her power and the authority that she has and she uses it for something really beautiful. In this passage, if you read this passage, you're probably still stuck there kind of going, tell me about the pigs. What's going on with the pigs? Why are the pigs in the story? Every commentator you read wants to discuss the pigs. And most of them all say, we really don't know why we have the pigs. But I think there might be some reason behind that. Because I think in verses 6 through 9, when you read about these pigs, there's something that is very clear for us. And it's the seriousness of sin or of evil in our lives, and particularly in the life of this man. It had been a part of his life, and it was there destroying him. It was pillaging. It was robbing this man of his humanity as he ripped and even tried to kill himself, and he was chained, and all of the things that we described, this man's sad, disturbed life. It reveals to us, when we read about this, and Jesus doesn't really have to give us an explanation. You just see it. This is not something you want to be a part of. You don't want it. It reveals something about the purpose and the intentions of evil and sin. And we see the death and the destruction of these 2,000 pigs, which would have been an economy for that little community. Get that. Then Jesus is revealing to these disciples and for us the true intention of sin and evil. John 10 says he's come to steal, kill, and destroy. It may look attractive, it may be attractive, it may be fun, but in the end, destruction is the point. And the only hope is that that would be met in your life and my life by something greater, a greater power, a greater authority. He gives us this disturbing, graphic picture of a seemingly hopelessly and in despair individual to say that help has arrived. And when Jesus sends these demons from the man into the nearby pig and they run down the hill and are destroyed, it's clear of the destructive intention of sin, but it's also clear that there's a greater power and a greater authority. Here's what you can know about the power and sin of your life. It has one purpose. Steal, kill, destroy. And you don't have the power, I don't have the power to stop it. We need a greater power. All sin intends to leave us worse off and ultimately destroy us. C.S. Lewis wrote, "It does not matter how small the sins are, provided their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light and out into the nothing." What we see is that sin doesn't play nice, and it does intend to ruin you. And it intends to suck the life and the marrow out of you and leaving you as a wreck. And that gossip and pride and envy and lying and stealing and addictions are some of the tools that he has used in our lives to enslave and destroy. And Jesus doesn't have to say to these disciples and the others that are watching, the power of sin and evil is real. He does not have to clarify that with them. It was obvious. But it's not just that he wants us to see the power of sin and evil. He wants to reveal his saving power in this passage. And there are several places in this text that give us that and are really clear. Verse 13 says that he gave them permission. It's clear that there's an authority structure here and that Jesus is on the top side of that. But notice this, that even though Jesus reveals and demonstrates his power and authority over evil, he does not put an end to evil. in this passage and a few verses later, they are begging Jesus to leave. So things are not all made right at that point. This semester, we've been looking at the miracles in our weekly dinner discussion. And miracles are amazing. They are amazing things. When he turns the water to wine, it's an amazing thing. And you can get caught stargazing and kind of going, he turned water into wine. But for Jesus, that was not the point. When he heals the paralytic, or he heals the man who's been an invalid for 38 years, or he raises the little girl, or the withered man, or whatever it is, those are amazing miracles. But John says they're signs, and they're pointing us to something bigger. And what they're pointing us to is a man who's going to come with all this power and authority, and he's going to give himself up, and he's going to go to a cross, and he's going to reverse the curse, and he's going to make all things new. And the resurrection is that receipt, right? It stamps it and says, hey, it makes all the other things true. But even yet now, we're still living in a time where there's still death and there's still brokenness. But we hold on to the resurrection with this hope that one day, what? All things will, that are sad, will be untrue. And that's the hope. And what Jesus is doing in this is he's saying, I'm giving you something to look forward to. I'm pulling back a curtain just so you know. I can deal with evil. I can deal with destruction. I can deal with it. Here's a peek. Trust me. Just keep following me. Just trust me. Just keep coming and seeing. I'm going to show you something you couldn't even imagine was going to happen. Paul writes in Colossians 2, with the perspective of looking back at the cross and the resurrection, he invites us. He says, continue to walk in him, rooted and built up in him, and established in the faith. He is offering us assurance. Paul is lifting our heads and directing us to see the victory that is certain. And in verse 15, he says, he's disarmed the rulers and authors and put them to open shame by triumphing over them. Listen, we live in that tension. This has already happened, but it's not yet. And that tension place that we live in right there is recognized at different times in our lives. Are you with me? Like, you long for the reality. You long for that day when the sad things will be untrue. But it's not yet. And Jesus is inviting us today to see that he has that power and authority. We have the privilege of looking back on the resurrection and having all sorts of evidences that allows us to hold on and to know that more than that, he's holding on to us and he's one day going to get us home. That one day, if you are in him and you die, he's going to reach into death and say, I'll take her. She's with me. And he's going to deliver you safely to the other side, where the reality of no sadness is true. One day, he's going to come and he's going to restore the magic. He's going to redeem the mess. So why does this matter to us? Why does this matter to you as a church? Verses 14 and 15. They tell us that the pigs go in and the townspeople run out and they go tell and say, you need to see what this guy's done. And they come back, and when they come back, they find this man and he's sitting there clothed in his right mind. Something's happened. And then the townspeople begin to beg Jesus to get out, leave. And as Jesus is getting into the boat to leave, something happens. The man comes to Jesus and he begs Jesus, "Can I go with you?" I mean, makes sense to me. Seems like a simple ask. But Jesus says no. No, he doesn't just say no. He says no and stay here and go tell your friends what the Lord has done for you. What is Jesus doing? He is leaving, but he tells the man to stay. In God's economy of ministry, he took his disciples, he loaded a boat, he says, "We're going to go to the other side to see one man." An unlikely candidate of his saving grace. Jesus isn't telling this man to stay because he's got it all figured out at this point. Long way from it. Not because he's perfect and knows all the answers. Jesus is sending this man out to be a witness, not of something that he's done, but of something that Jesus has done. It's very simple. It wasn't about his accomplishments, but it was about what Jesus had accomplished in him. Jesus is going to be gone. He's going to be long gone from the Decapolis. But walking around the streets, up and down Main Street, Decapolis is going to be formerly the Gerasene naked man, who's now been clothed and in his right mind, and people are going to see him. And they're going to know. The reason Jesus stayed, because it's a more beautiful story. It's a beautiful story because if Jesus had not done what he did and he had taken the man with him, they would have just remembered that Jesus came in and wrecked our economy. What they now, Jesus came in and made a man right. He left him there as a Gentile missionary to a Gentile people, a witness to the nations. Good news for those who are far off, unreachable, and untouchable. How does this get really personal to a church? I had the privilege of pastoring a church for 13 years, and we were always trying to figure out, how do we reach into our community? It sounds like y'all, and I've walked up and down your hall, saw your mission board, and you've got missionaries that you support and stuff like that. But that's really the rub. You're called as God's missionaries in this community. This is what a friend of mine told me about what happened to them in their church one day. See if it might help. He says, "When our church plant was about a year old, I will never forget one late afternoon when I had gathered the leaders together for a strategic planning meeting. You know how hard it is to get everyone together for these kind of meetings, so I was pumped that the whole team was available to be there. As I was about to start, the front door swung open and in came John, a slender, speckled young man with unkempt black hair. He hobbled in on a crutch to relieve the pain in his leg, which was a bloody mess from being hit by a car. Without looking, he said, 'Excuse me, could I speak with someone?' My friend breathed a deep sigh, and flippantly cast a glance toward the planning team as if to say, 'Give me a minute to deal with this interruption so we can get back to the important business of the church.' As John and I entered my office, I asked him, 'What can I do for you? Do you want some money or some food?' He meekly expressed the question of his heart. 'I don't want a handout. I don't want any food or money. Could you just speak to me as if I was a human?' He had been abused as a child and treated like an object to be discarded most of his life. He had just tried to kill himself by throwing himself in front of a car. It was obvious that he was broken, sinful, and messed up in so many ways. God used him to remind us of our concealed sin and brokenness. We were just as much in need of God's grace as him. By God's grace, the Lord slowly brought healing and redemption to John and our church to treat everyone as if they were human. When I asked him, I said, did John stick around? This is what he said. He said, yeah. He sat in the back corner by himself at church for a month. Then several of our folks sat with him. Then he felt comfortable and moved to the middle with folks. He came to the Lord, got his sobriety chip, moved into an apartment after his treatment program, got involved and had friendships. He later moved to another town. He had to heal physically, psychologically, socially, and spiritually. Why does Jesus invite these disciples to come to the other side with him? Why does he take them through a storm before he gets to the other side? I think he's preparing them for what lies ahead in ministry, the messiness of ministry, the value of being present and showing up, and our own need to trust. Have you forgotten that Jesus shows up in the lives of broken people and in broken places and makes things new? I really do. I suspect that majority of people in here know that story very well. But I'll tell you what happened. When I read Juan's testimony, I was reminded of a God who seeks to save the lost. Even those growing up in some huge town in China who doesn't believe in him. In the amazing picture of grace that has captured Juan's heart, has begun to renew a flame in my own heart. To be reminded that wherever I go, I'm passing individuals, people who bear the image of God, and that whoever walks through the doors of a church or into a meeting, they are there because God, in his providence and his sovereignty, as we sang about earlier, wanted them there. And I pray that God would give me the eyes to see, and that I would search the horizon, that I would scan the horizon looking for that person that may be looking for just to be treated as a human. Surely we can do that. Because that's what Jesus does in this passage. It's one individual to a seemingly inconsequential region of the Decapolis where they weren't looking for Jesus. They didn't want Jesus. But he showed up there. And he changed a man's life. If you go and you read the next few chapters of Mark, you'll see that Jesus goes back to that community. And when he does, that place is different. And they're thankful that he's come back. Would you pray with me?